Law of the Jungle. Among the 115 mammal species on Barrow, Colorado Island in the Panama Canal, there is an irregularly shifting population of Homo scientificus, and this includes short-term migrant visitors invited for a month or so to interact with, and it is hoped refresh and invigorate, the resident population of biologists. In 1980, I was privileged to be invited as one of two birds of passage, the other being, I was delighted to hear, the great John Maynard Smith. The densely forested Barrow, Colorado Island sits in the middle of Lake Gatun, which forms a substantial chunk of the Panama Canal, and is home to a world-renowned tropical research centre run by the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute, STRI. Why such forests are so rich in species is one of the perennial questions in ecology. Their biodiversity outstrips all other major ecosystems, and the 6 square miles of Barrow, Colorado are surely, with the possible exception of Whiteham Wood near Oxford, the most intensively studied, most picked over, most analysed, most binocular scanned, most mapped square miles of forest in the world. What a privilege to be invited there for a month. At the time of my visit, Ira Rubinoff, the director of STRI in Panama, who originally invited me, was going on sabbatical leave, leaving the institute in the capable and genial hands of his deputy, my old friend Michael Robinson. Mike and I had been fellow graduate students of Nico Tinbergen at Oxford in the 1960s. He was a little older than the rest of us, having gone back to university as a mature student to indulge his passion for entomology, after what some, not I, might consider a misspent youth as a left-wing agitator. At that stage of his life, British troops were fighting insurgents in Malaya, and Mike once spent a whole night rushing around the streets of Manchester, painting slogans on wall after wall after wall, "Hands off Malaya! Hands off Malaya! Hands off Malaya!" Dawn came, and he prepared to crawl off to bed, unarrested, and with a good feeling of a night well spent, and Manchester well and truly taught a lesson. He looked up at his final door with a sigh of satisfaction, and noticed to his horror that it said, "Hands of Malaya." He didn't need to go back to check his earlier handiwork. A sinking hindsight told him that all his slogans throughout the night contained the same slip, mechanically repeated from the first one. When, after completing an excellent doctoral thesis on stick insects at Oxford, Mike was offered a job at STRI, his officially organised itinerary to Panama took him via Miami. Because he had once been a member of the Communist Party, the US authorities refused to grant him a visa to touch down in Miami, even though he would never leave the airport's secure area, and in spite of the fact that his fully agreed salary in Panama was to be paid by the US government. Stalemate. I forget how it was resolved, but he did eventually make it to Panama. All must later have been comprehensively forgiven, or at least officially forgotten, because he eventually rose to become director of the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., one of the most famous zoos in the world. At the time of my visit to Panama, he was accepted enough to be acting director of STRI, and was still exactly as I remembered him, that rosily beaming face with its little red goatee and matching apical tuft on the top of the head. A young woman in Oxford seeking to establish which one he was in a group had once whispered to me, "Is he the one with the little beard?" while her accompanying hand gesture cheekily indicated the top of the head. My guide when I arrived in Panama was another old friend from Oxford days, Fritz Follrat, the Spider-Man. If Mike Robinson was cheerful, Fritz is world-class cheerful, but with none of the negative connotations of the life and soul of the party, more the life and soul of everyday life itself. I first encountered his quizzically laughing eyes when he arrived in Oxford from Germany to work as a teenage slave in the Tinbergen group. He was introduced by the wildly brilliant Juan Delius, his cousin, who was at that time a leading member of the group. Fritz immediately fitted in, laughing at his own broken English even more than the rest of us did. When I met him again in Panama years later, he had scarcely changed. His English was much better, and his Spanish didn't seem at all bad either. We drove around the environs of Panama City, pausing to watch a sloth as it slowly descended from a tree for its weekly defecation. We climbed a peak in Darien, alas, not the very one where, as I murmured to myself, Stout Cortez, with his eagle eyes, silently stared at the Pacific, and all his men looked at each other with a wild surmise. Fritz was based in Panama City, while I was bound for Barrow, Colorado, in the interior of the country. But it was a delight to see him for just that one day. He is now back in Oxford, close friend and distinguished authority on spiders, their behaviour, and the unparalleled properties of their silk. The journey from Panama City to Barrow, Colorado is by a small rattling train with unpadded wooden seats. It stops by Lake Gatun, halfway across the peninsula, at a tiny halt, too small and deserted to be called a station. Hard by is a landing stage, and every train is met by a boat from the island, or at least is supposed to be met. On one occasion during my month, John and Sheila Maynard Smith had gone on a day trip to Panama City. They returned late on the last train and were pleased to see the boat chugging towards the dock. Then, to their dismay, it suddenly turned around and headed back to the island. Apparently the boatman had decided it was so unlikely anyone would be on the last train that he might as well not bother even to look. The Maynard Smiths shouted and yelled, but the wretched man didn't hear them above the engine noise. There was no telephone, and so the elderly couple were forced to spend the night at the halt, with little shelter and nothing but wooden boards to sleep on. They were surprisingly nice about it the next morning. I never discovered whether the boatman was sacked, nor what mental aberration caused him to turn the boat around without troubling to check if anyone was waiting for him, nor why, indeed, if he had no intention of going to the station dock, he had bothered embarking in the first place. At the time of my own first arrival, all went according to plan, and the boat did its duty. From the island's small dock, you climb steep steps to the main compound of the Research Institute, a purpose-built cluster of red-roofed houses and laboratories. My bedroom proved to be bare but functional, and I didn't mind the companionable large cockroaches. Two cooks provided hot meals at set times in the communal dining room, where the researchers gathered to eat and talk. There were probably about a dozen of them when I was there, mostly graduate students and postdocs. A postdoctoral fellowship is the normal next step of a bright young academic scientist after completing a PhD, working on a range of subjects from ants to palm trees. Most were from North America, one from India, and the Indian biologist Raghavendra Gadakar was of particular interest to me as he was working on wasps, the primitively social Ropalidia, which plausibly might represent an intermediate on the diagram Jane Brockman and I had constructed for our paper, published in the journal Behaviour the previous year, on potential evolutionary origins of insect sociality. More of this in the next chapter. I don't think I imagined this. The social atmosphere in the dining room and around the compound seemed a tiny bit colder than I'd become accustomed to among groups of working scientists. It thawed markedly later during my month there, and I eventually felt accepted enough to remark on it, at which point I was told that this was a well-acknowledged characteristic of the place, which the residents attributed to the fact that they were on an island. I wasn't sure how to tie this psychological insight in with my knowledge of the theory of island biogeography, the title of a famous book by two old Barrow, Colorado hands, Robert MacArthur, who died tragically young, and Edward O. Wilson. But after I had been on the island a month, I too found myself feeling ever so slightly territorial when newcomers arrived. I therefore made a conscious effort to counteract this by going out of my way to befriend the latest arrival before I was to leave, Nancy Garwood, at the New Year's Eve party. As it turned out, she had been there before, so didn't need me to go out of my way, but I'm glad I did, and I hope she was too. This party was also memorable because of the firework display on a huge ship passing through the canal just beyond the trees. Actually, falsely memorable, because for years I have been utterly convinced that we saw in not just a new year, but a new decade, 1st of January 1980. So detailed and full were my recollections of seeing the new decade in, it took multiple documentary evidence kindly sent me by Ira Rubinoff, Raghavendra Gadakar, and Nancy Garwood to finally convince me that what I had thought to be a crystal-clear memory was faulty. It was actually the 1st of January 1981, not 1980. I was quite shaken to discover this because it made me worry how many other clear memories actually never happened, and the reader of my memoir is, I suppose, duly warned. The dreamlike presence of large tankers deep in the jungle was one of the most vivid memories I took away from the place. On several afternoons, I had joined the resident scientists swimming off a raft, and it was a surreal experience to see those gigantic vessels gliding calmly and surprisingly quietly through the still, clear water, just a few yards away behind the trees. Some of the women scientists liked to sunbathe, and I couldn't help wondering what the tanker crews thought about the undraped feminine pulchritude diving off the raft deep in the jungle. If those mariners were Greek, did they think sirens? Or if German, Lorelei? Or, peering through the lush tropical vegetation, did they see a vision of Eve's innocence before the fall? They had no way of knowing that these tropic nymphs had PhDs in science from some of the top universities in America. I've mentioned the apparent territoriality of those busy and dedicated scientists whose island fastness I was briefly allowed to invade, but I mustn't exaggerate it. I learned from friendly experts most days, either in the field or in the dining room. Elizabeth Reut independently noted the same slight initial froideur in her book about her own visit to Barrow, Colorado, the tapir's morning bath. For her, as for me, it thawed later as she gradually became accepted as an in-group islander and was allowed to help with the research. The first to befriend her was the senior scientist on the island, the delightfully eccentric Egbert Lee, and he was hospitable to me too. I already knew his name as the author of a thought-provoking paper on The Parliament of Genes, and was quite surprised to find this deep-thinking theorist deep in the Central American forest. But there he was, with his family, in the only permanent residence on the island, known as Toad Hall. Toadish, I later learned, was an epithet of high praise in Dr. Lee's vocabulary. I never quite discovered what it meant to him. I suspect something multifaceted and subtle, like spin, in the private vocabulary of the English mathematician G.H. Hardy, a term of approbation derived in his case from cricket, whose exact meaning C.P. Snow struggled to elucidate in his affectionate memoir of Hardy. Egbert Lee and I found common ground in our admiration for R.A. Fisher, and he barked out his appreciation in accents best summed up in the phrase, I can't trace the origin of the witticism, irritable vowel syndrome. If the island housed theoretical firepower in the form of Egbert Lee, the intellectual armoury was massively afforced again with the arrival of John Maynard Smith, the first half of whose month as visiting consultant overlapped with the second half of mine. John always was a man eager to learn as well as teach, and it was wonderful to walk the jungle trails in his company and learn biology from him, as well as learn from him how to learn from the local experts who conducted us. I treasure an aside from him about one young man who was walking us through his research area. What a treat it is to listen to a man who really loves his animals. The animals in this case were palm trees, but that was John all over, and one of the reasons I loved him and miss him. Among the actual animals, as opposed to photosynthetic honorary animals, were the well-named spider monkeys, with their splendid fifth limb in the form of the prehensile tail, and the howler monkeys, with their bone-amplified voice boxes, whose travelling waves of crescendos and decrescendos could easily be mistaken for a squadron of jet fighters roaring through the canopy. On one occasion I encountered a full-grown tapir, close enough to see the ticks on its neck, engorged with its blood. It was hard to walk a day in the jungle without picking up one's own cargo of ticks. But they were always small when they first hitched a ride, and everyone carried a roll of sticky tape to peel them off. Tapirs, by the way, seem never to have occurred in Africa, so it was a bit of a solecism for Stanley Kubrick to portray them as hunted by our hominin ancestors at the beginning of that magnificent film, 2001, A Space Odyssey. Insofar as I got any constructive work done during my time in Panama, it took the form of writing chapters of The Extended Phenotype, and in this I was helped by discussions with some of the scientists on the island. From the dates, I know that I spent Christmas 1980 on the island, but I remember nothing about it, which suggests that not a lot of fuss was made of the occasion. I do recall some kind of a party with a cabaret, which may have been associated with Christmas. Raghavendra Gadakar was co-opted to act as Master of Ceremonies, somewhat to his bemusement, I think, as he had only just arrived. I discovered a special affinity for the leafcutter ants introduced to me by Alan Hare, along with the more sinister army ants, who one night invaded a bathroom and linked limbs to hang in there, festooned like noisome brown-black curtains. Alan was not the only regular who earnestly warned me about the giant ponarine ants, Paraponera, whose formidable sting placed them among the most talked-about denizens of the jungle. My fear-primed eyes saw them often, and I kept my distance with the utmost respect. I found the leafcutter ants more appealing, and would stand for what seemed like hours watching the flowing green torrents of walking leaves, tens of thousands of workers, each with its verdant parasol held aloft, en route for the dark subterranean fungus gardens. I was filled with naive fascination that they were cutting leaves not to slake their own taste for greenery, either now or later, but to make compost on which to grow fungi which would eventually be eaten by others in their teeming colony after they themselves had died. Were they motivated by some myrmecine equivalent of an appetite, which was satisfied not by a full stomach, but by, say, the feel of a leaf in the jaws, or something even more indirect? I didn't need John Maynard Smith to remind me that natural selection favours strategies, which are not assumed to be understood by the animals that act them out. It is not for us to say whether ants feel any conscious appetites or desires, wants or hungers. I felt a glow of understanding, which was repeated in an encounter with the army ants, later described in my third book, The Blind Watchmaker. I explained that, as a child in Africa, I had been more afraid of driver ants than of lions or crocodiles. But I quoted E. O. Wilson to the effect that a driver ant colony is an object less of menace than of strangeness and wonder, the culmination of an evolutionary story as different from that of mammals as it is possible to conceive in this world. And I continued. As an adult in Panama, I have stepped aside and contemplated the new world equivalent of the driver ants that I had feared as a child in Africa, flowing by me like a crackling river, and I can testify to the strangeness and wonder. Hour after hour the legions marched past, walking as much over each other's bodies as over the ground, while I waited for the queen. Finally she came, and hers was an awesome presence. Today I could not use awesome, the word has become so debased, it is now no more than a routine term of mild approval. Yes, yes, I know, language evolves, chill out, Professor. I still lament the loss of a valuable word. Awe-inspiring would spoil the rhythm of the sentence. It was impossible to see her body. She appeared only as a moving wave of worker frenzy, a boiling peristaltic ball of ants with linked arms. She was somewhere in the middle of the seething ball of workers, while all around it the massed ranks of soldiers faced threateningly outwards, with jaws agape, every one prepared to kill and to die in defence of the Queen. Forgive my curiosity to see her. I prodded the ball of workers with a long stick in a vain attempt to flush out the Queen. Instantly, 20 soldiers buried their massively muscled pincers in my stick, possibly never to let go, while dozens more swarmed up the stick, causing me to let go with alacrity. I never did glimpse the Queen, but somewhere inside that boiling ball she was, the central data bank, the repository of the master DNA of the whole colony. Those gaping soldiers were prepared to die for the Queen, not because they loved their mother, not because they'd been drilled in the ideals of patriotism, but simply because their brains and their jaws were built by genes stamped from the master dye carried in the Queen herself. They behaved like brave soldiers because they had inherited the genes of a long line of ancestral queens whose lives and whose genes had been saved by soldiers as brave as themselves. My soldiers had inherited the same genes from the present queen as those old soldiers had inherited from the ancestral queens. My soldiers were guarding the master copies of the very instructions that made them do the guarding. They were guarding the wisdom of their ancestors, the Ark of the Covenant. I felt the strangeness then and the wonder, not unmixed with revivals of half-forgotten fears, but transfigured and enhanced by a mature understanding, which I had lacked as a child in Africa, of what the whole performance was for. Enhanced, too, by the knowledge that this story of the legions had reached the same evolutionary culmination not once, but twice. These were not the driver ants of my childhood nightmares, however similar they might be, but remote New World cousins. They were doing the same thing as the driver ants, and for the same reasons. It was night now, and I turned for home, an awe-struck child again, but joyful in the new world of understanding that had supplanted the dark African fears. I made a half-hearted attempt at some quantitative observations on the leafcutter ants, but I never really got anywhere. There wasn't enough time. And I fear I'm not very good at getting down to properly planned research with a specified end. I can do pilot experiments, flitting like a butterfly as the interest takes me, but to do real research you have to write down the time course of the project in advance and adhere to it rigorously. Otherwise it's too easy to stop when you have the result you want, and that, if not quite deliberate cheating, has been a serious source of error in the history of science. I spent much of a day watching in horrified fascination a clash between two rival colonies of leafcutters, which made me think of the First World War. The large battlefield became littered with limbs, heads and abdomens. I hoped and half believed that the ants didn't feel pain or fear. They were acting out genetically programmed automatisms, wound up like clockwork in their tiny brains, Maynard Smithian strategies. But that doesn't in itself mean they didn't feel pain. I'd be pretty surprised if they did, but I can imagine no way of deciding the question. The mind of an academic needs refreshing by such an interlude as mine in Panama with dear JMS. And when I returned to everyday life in Oxford, it seemed just that little bit less every day.